From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at the New Hope Academy School in Franklin, Tennessee, where teachers were meeting to talk about school illnesses, and they were not talking about COVID. They were discussing the other kinds of illnesses that kids get every year: strep throat, common colds, influenza. Fourth grade teacher Nicole Grayson said that she was something she had never seen before. She could not think of a single one of her students who had gotten sick this school year. No cases of the flu, no strep, no colds, and they've been back in the classroom for a while. As NPR reports, teachers and doctors across the country are marveling at the difference that masking and physical distancing has made. Illnesses are way down in children. A new study from researchers at Vanderbilt University Medical Center found that across 44 children's hospitals, the number of kids hospitalized for respiratory illnesses is down 62% overall. Deaths are also down. A typical flu season usually results in between about 100 and 200 kids dying in this country. But this flu season, only one child has died from the flu. And as NPR notes, adults are not getting sick either. When's the last time you got sick? I think it's been more than a year for me. Flu deaths are a tiny fraction of a typical season for adults, and other infections are on the decline. All of which leads to some interesting questions. Will you keep your masks after the COVID pandemic subsides? Will you mask up when you shop groceries? Will we have sort of a masking season during the colder months? Will we take other precautions? Here's one near certainty that I would predict. We're going to tolerate coworkers coming to work sick a whole lot less than we used to. And what about sending kids to schools when they're sick or kind of borderline? Our guests this hour have a great deal of experience and perspectives on these issues, and let me welcome them now. Dr. Elizabeth Murray is a professor of pediatrics and emergency medicine and faculty director for child health and safety communications for Golisano Children's Hospital at Strong. Dr. Murray, welcome back to the program.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
Dr. Nicole Sifra is with us, an adolescent fellow and a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital at Strong. Dr. Sifra, welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having me, Evan.
And Dr. Steve Cook is a professor of pediatrics at Golisano Children's Hospital at Strong and medical director at the New York State Department of Health. Dr. Cook, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone.
We will get to audience questions later in the hour, and I know there are some questions that parents and listeners already have about kids and COVID, and we'll get there, but I want to start with just a general sort of outlook on health and what our guests have been seeing in kids. Dr. Murray, I mentioned that study out of Vanderbilt University found big declines. Are you seeing the same when it comes to kids and just common illnesses?
Definitely, definitely. And, you know, thank goodness that was the case, because if you look back to when we were in the biggest surge of the COVID pandemic so far, you know, we needed the bed space in the children's hospital to help care for adults. I mean, those beds are historically are completely full, if not overflowing, with kids with respiratory syncytial virus and flu and other respiratory illnesses in the fall and winter months. But that did not happen this year, which allowed us to be able to help the adult population through the pandemic as well. But I will say, you know, I work in the emergency department, and in the past few weeks, we've seen a few more kids who've been wheezing and having kind of general respiratory illnesses, but they still haven't been flu, they haven't been COVID, it hasn't been RSV, it's just been general kind of cold symptoms that have been triggering asthma. So definitely different.
Dr. Sifra, what are you seeing?
So I am an adolescent medicine fellow, so mostly I care for teens, and particularly teens with mental health challenges, particularly eating disorders. I have heard from my patients, however, that they have not been sick. They haven't been out of school for reason of being ill. And I just want to draw attention as well to the data from the New York State Department of Health regarding flu illnesses, which is reported and is widely available. I tweet these graphs every once in a while because they're just so remarkable, but you can see that the flu has been really almost non-existent. We call it flu asystole sometimes, which is really just remarkable.
Mm. And Dr. Cook, what about you? What are you seeing?
I agree. This is what we're seeing. We're seeing people also reporting, to some extent, less allergy symptoms. One of the interesting things that we also observed over the summer at our hospital was our NICU, and that those beds being less of those, and that's
Oh, we lost you for a second, Dr. Cook. Dropped off the call. Let's see if we can...
Interesting finding, too, that is related to... So there was less premature birth, and that felt to be related to some type of environmental exposure that was triggering women to go into labor, whether it was an infection or some other component. So there are definitely things that are occurring that we probably couldn't predict that we have to take into account. You know, there's dramatic changes in distance and masking and hygiene are having a lot of benefit.
Now, when you say allergies are down, Dr. Cook, I mean, I'm puzzled on that one. Is there anything that stands out as to why?
Well, this is I'm reporting this as hearing from symptomatically. I've not seen data to this. And the thought is, are we just not out as much getting exposed to different allergy triggers? So the seasonal ones are going to come. We know that. But in the winter, in the summer, mainly in the winter when you don't have as much of the pollen allergies, are these related to other things that are triggering them? And it may be partly infection, too. But seasonal allergies are coming, so that's, you know, we're not going to stop the plants with the social distancing. But might the masks be a benefit? I don't know. They might.
Well, okay. So on the subject, then, of sort of where we go from here, because I think everybody agrees it's nice to be able to look back and say, I haven't been sick in forever. That's what my 9-year-old said. Walking into Target, and he goes, I think I'm just going to keep my mask forever. He said, I can't remember the last time I got sick. And my first thought, Dr. Cook, was, you don't want to keep your mask forever. I don't want him burning the masks. I'm not really sure that that sends a good or helpful message. But I, you know, eventually I think we all want to be more closer together like we have been in the past. I think we all look forward to not only gathering, but kind of getting back to some sense of normalcy. But I do take the point that there are certain things that will probably stick with us. I mean, can you see, Dr. Cook, the average person, and even doctors and hospital staff, keeping more masks on hand post-pandemic than ever before? Is that realistic to you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, unfortunately, as doctors, we get sick often from our patients, and I think that's definitely a component of what we're going to be doing just for our own workforce to stay healthier. And like you said before, a different tolerance for coming into work if you're feeling a little off. So I definitely see that. You know, part of this too is where are lots of germs spread. So in big gatherings, people may wear masks more. But if you go over to someone's house for a play date and people are vaccinated, I'm not saying, you know, the mask will stay there. So it's, you know, it's going to be in different contexts and it's going to evolve.
Yeah. Dr. Siffer, do you expect that we'll see more masking, you know, whether it's just individuals who are a little concerned about getting sick or people who, you know, might feel more comfortable at a store or an indoor setting? I mean, is that likely, do you think, even post-pandemic?
I think so. I think that there are, you know, several situations that when individuals perceive they're at high risk for getting a contagious virus, whether it be COVID or something else, that they will choose to wear a mask. You know, for example, when you're in the waiting room at the doctor's office or when you're traveling, I can see a lot of people choosing to wear masks in those situations down the road.
Dr. Murray, same for you. What do you think?
Yeah, I think probably the last place that masks will stop, if they ever stop, would be in the healthcare setting. I anticipate us in the hospital setting will probably be wearing masks for a long time. There have always been situations where we've masked children and adults when they are ill. You know, for example, if somebody came in with a respiratory virus before the pandemic to the emergency department for evaluation and they were old enough, we would put a mask on them. So that stuff was actually happening a little bit before, but certainly it wasn't as widespread as it is now. You know, I think too, the overall appreciation of all of the things that can go into helping keep people healthy, you know, that awareness has increased so much during the pandemic that, you know, we're still going to have a lot of benefit from increased hand washing and just general concepts of disease spread that is going to help us out. And I think, as Liz mentioned, you know, the concept of not going to work sick, we now have a new appreciation for that, where in the past I think that was given a lot of lip service, but I think we have now a real appreciation for that. So some masks will be around for a while, but probably not for everybody.
I'm going to get back to the work question in a moment here, because I've got a real bone to pick with, I don't know, all bosses or society, except for mine. Ours are really. No, I'm mostly kidding here. But, I mean, I do want to get back to that in a moment here. And I want to encourage listeners, I'd like to hear from you if you've got questions or comments for the doctors on our panel today. You know, what behaviors do you think are sort of permanent or semi-permanent changes? How do you feel more comfortable when you're out in public, even if you're vaccinated now? I mean, I'm fully vaccinated. I touched a door handle in public today, and I was kind of like, ooh, I shouldn't have done that. I mean, it's just amazing how your mindset starts to change. And I'd love to hear from you. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994, or email us, connections@WXXI.org. If I could ask all three of you just to give us your thoughts on one important lesson we've learned in the last year, and that's on kids and masking. And Dr. Murray, let me start with you. A year ago, we heard some in our community, some across the country, saying kids will never tolerate masking. Kids won't go to school with masks. Kids need to be able to see each other's full faces. It's not natural. All kinds of various complaints about whether it could even happen. What have we learned in a year?
The kids actually do a fabulous job, and a lot of times are better at it than adults. At least that's certainly what I've seen. You know, kids do just fine with it. And if they're going to struggle, it's usually because the adults in their environment are struggling with it as well. And that's okay. You know, kids are going to pick up what's going on in their environment, but for the most part, kids are doing just fine with it. And I think we've also seen kids really, again, start to appreciate that they have the ability to help and be part of the solution by making sure they're doing a good job washing their hands and following other instructions when it comes to physical distancing in the classroom. So, you know, certainly there has been a toll on everybody, including children in this pandemic, whether it comes from physical illness or loss of a relative, or certainly loss of experience of in-person school. Everybody has had their own struggles that they've gone through. But when it comes to masking specifically, we really have seen children with all sorts of medical problems, all sorts of developmental differences, for the most part, do really, really well.
And let me just make sure I understand one point that I think you're making. When you say if kids are struggling, it's typically because the adults in their lives are struggling with masking?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I've seen. If a parent says, I hate wearing this mask, then their child is going to pick up on that and probably say the same thing. It's a lot to ask our children to correct us, right? But they do that sometimes. They do that. My 4-year-old made sure we washed our hands for a whole song that she had to sing. and that's good. And that's appropriate. I'm glad she's advocating for help. But, you know, we have to set expectations for our children because that's what we do as parents. And so I think that for adults who struggle with it or get frustrated with it, which we're all going to be frustrated at certain times, but those who are continuously frustrated with it, their kids are often the ones who are going to struggle too.
Dr. Murray, it's a badge of honor to be child-splained. That means kids are paying attention.
I think it's just a parent of a toddler. I think that's what that is.
Oh, but man, absolutely. Oh, my gosh, yes. Dr. Siffer, what do you think we've learned in the last year, particularly when it comes to kids, minors, masking, and lessons there?
So I think one of the things that I've learned is that kids are incredibly resilient and incredibly adaptable. And I think a lot of people didn't realize the extent to which they were. I've been so impressed at from, you know, kids that I know in my personal life, as well as patients of mine, how well that they've dealt with all of the, you know, ups and downs and changing information, masking, different, you know, settings for school. They've really just done a great job. And I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of us go into pediatrics, because kids are adaptable, they're resilient, they bounce back. And I think that we've really seen that during this pandemic.
Mm. Dr. Cook, what have you learned? If you're there, Steve. Oh, boy. We're in and out with Steve. You might have been on mute.
I mean, I might have been on mute, probably.
Have you learned in a year to check whether you're on mute? I haven't, by the way.
I still haven't learned that, no.
I
would echo what my colleagues are saying here, that, children learn whether we realize we're teaching them or not. They learn our bad habits. They learn our good habits. Mm. And anxiety is a social contagion disease. You know, we have genetic susceptibility to it, but the more anxiety people experience with people around them, the more they're going to struggle. You know, the wearing a mask isn't a physical health issue. It's a behavioral health issue. And with kids, a lot of times it's the parents' behavior, not the kids. They've done outstanding with it. That's not to say that kids have gotten through this easily. You know, kids need to get back into social settings and interact. and this has been a huge mental health struggle. But you set simple rules, consistent rules for kids, and they do just fine. It's just us as adults that struggle with it more.
Yeah, I find that so interesting. And, you know, Steve, to the point there about setting simple rules, even simple explanations about why we're doing this. Kids just want to know why, and as long as they sort of get it, they're really good at explaining it, as Dr. Murray found out. But, I mean, as everybody finds out, I think the kids have really, really done well. I agree with all of you on that. Now, let me read an email from a listener named Tom who says, Evan, I can definitely see myself wearing a mask in public if I feel a little under the weather. However, I'm concerned that employers will use mask wearing as a way to force workers to come to work when they're too sick to do so. I think this would most likely happen to grocery store, restaurant, and retail workers. I know this sounds cynical, but I've been the manager of a retail store owned by a large corporation. Taking sick time, even as a manager, was highly discouraged. And looking back, I can 100% imagine that the higher-ups at corporate will be telling managers that part-time employees are expected to report for work, even if they're showing symptoms, and to simply wear masks. Do you or your panel have any thoughts about how employers might use lessons from the pandemic to further exploit their employees in a post-COVID world? Thanks so much for considering. That's from Tom. Dr. Cook, I'll start with you.
You know, I think it's really going to be a challenge because there's always going to be people looking for shortcuts. And I do have that concern, you know, getting the culture, a workforce culture, to not think I've got to tough it up and not come in when I'm sick, but there's always going to be people looking at bending the rules. And, you know, hopefully we can not stick to these older rules and be a little more creative with how we're trying to address solutions, you know, with the government, we flip the switch and we could start doing telemedicine like crazy. And that's really altered healthcare. Can we look at how we educate children? Can we look at, you know, how we run businesses as employers and HR managers and try to have more accommodations in ways that are productive and not punitive?
I think that's well said. And Dr. Sifra, one of the things that comes to mind for me is, you know, there used to sort of be kind of this this badge of honor that, well, this person shows up even when they're sick. This person's never missed a day of work in their life. This person comes to work and they're obviously in rough shape, but they're just dedicated to the job. I think, at least in my perspective, that the perspective on people who force themselves to get to work even when they're sick will start to change with this, and that will be viewed as reckless in many settings. What do you think?
Absolutely, I agree. And I think that the healthcare situation is a prime example of this. I can only speak with my experience as a physician, but there are so many stories from colleagues of mine and myself where, you know, people have gone to work in all sorts of medical situations and, you know, it's viewed as dedication and it's a culture issue. But I see that that's definitely changed in the last year. And I think that, you know, I'm very hopeful that that will carry forward because it is a concern for getting someone else ill and no one wants to do that and no one wants to put anyone else at risk. And so I'm hopeful that we can remember that even when COVID is gone.
I think that is so important for all of us. I appreciate the great attendance, but I'd rather not get sick myself. So coworkers, stay home. Dr. Murray, you know, when we think about Tom's email and his concern that management might say, okay, well, just wear a mask, what is the actual sort of medical advice for how far masking will go if you are truly sick, whether it's common cold, strep throat, whatever the case may be? You know, I think it's important for managers to understand what masks can and can't do. What do you think?
Right. It depends on the germ. You know, if somebody's got a stomach bug, a mask's probably not going to help all that much, you know, and you wouldn't want that person around you anyways, I would hope. So, I mean, I hope that employers can kind of flip it on its head and say, you know, not only have we learned the importance of grace and the importance of taking care of each other and watching out for each other's health, but we've also learned that telemedicine can work in a lot of situations. Zoom meetings can work in a lot of situations. I think that school attendance awards are probably done now, hopefully, and that school can sometimes be done in a remote situation if need be for kids who are, you know, sick but not feeling down for the count where they have to sleep all day. So, you know, I think that we've also seen employers like the University of Rochester allow for time off after vaccination if you were having vaccine side effects without it counting against your paid time off. So I hope that we can kind of remind employers to continue, like I said, to flip it to the other side of see what is possible instead of just trying to squeeze that last extra little bit out of your employees, because masks are not a panacea. They can help with some things, but they certainly can't help with everything.
And Dr. Murray, would you advise schools to stop giving awards for perfect attendance?
I've never personally been a fan of it because I don't know that it's like a skill or something that the child has to work for. And I think it also makes kids feel bad if they get sick. Sometimes kids get sick. Sometimes kids need an appendix removed. You know, I never really got it as an award thing anyways, but I think now I really, really don't think it should be around. There's plenty of other things we can honor children's good work for.
All right, small pile of listener questions on these and related subjects. Amy writes in to say, with my kids in school, at least in recent years, it's all been about fever. If your kid has a fever, don't send them to school. If there's just a light cough, you can send them. Is that going to change, and why is fever always the benchmark? Dr. Murray, let me start with you.
Fever not always, but often can just be a sign of a little bit more of an illness or potentially a clue towards something that would need treatment, like strep throat. Sometimes ear infections, depending on the age of the child. So, you know, I think fever definitely has a bit of a lore associated with it, that fever in and of itself is not dangerous, but again, it could be a symptom of a bigger problem. It's hard to say. I just don't know where things are going to go, but, you know, anytime a child was kind of coughing out of control or full of mucus, it seems, you know, intuitive that they are at risk of spreading that germ to another child that they're around. So having that kid stay home made sense as well. So my guess is that, you know, the rules about fever, the suggestions about fever are still going to continue, though maybe we'll have it broaden a little bit more.
Okay. And Dr. Sifra, something else, reading Amy's email comes to mind for me. And I want to pose this to you in a way that is not at all mocking or demeaning it, really lovingly. I mean, if we think of people who we would think are hypochondriacs, perhaps, I mean, there's probably someone in our lives who we can think of who is always on edge about their health or looking for signs that something is wrong. Again, I'm not mocking at all. I mean, I understand people have different levels of anxiety about their own health, or sometimes it's parents about their kids' health. The flip side of this, you know, which might seem to me to be a pendulum swinging too far the other way, would be that everybody, you know, freaks out the second they've got a light cough or an allergy, and kids don't go to school and people don't go to work. How do we find a balance there, Dr. Sifra?
Mm-hmm. I think it definitely is a balance. And I think that that's where parents really can partner with their child's healthcare provider or pediatrician. Their pediatrician, although, you know, they care for their patients, they are a little bit more objective than the parent. And so I think that this is a great opportunity for parents to really have a trusting relationship with their child's provider. And, you know, they know their child best, and any good pediatrician would acknowledge that. And so the partnership there, I think, is really important, especially when there's so much anxiety.
Let me grab a phone call, and we're going to stick on related subjects for a second here. Many questions still on masking. Ray in Macedon, go ahead, Ray.
Hey, Evan, thanks so much for being such a great facilitator. I'm old school, but I'm listening to the alternate narrative about masks and lockdowns and such, and it seems like we're making a presupposition that masks actually work when this other narrative is saying that there's no peer-reviewed studies that contend that masks actually work. So I'm wondering, you know, why are we continuing with that presupposition if it's not true? And by the way, I'm not that passionate in my belief because I graduated as a toilet cleaner. So what the hell do I know?
Oh, no. I think it's fair to ask what we do know and don't know scientifically and what the studies have said. And I think that's always good to keep our eyes on that. And so, Ray, I appreciate that. And so let me kick it over to the guests. And let me also say that there's a really good, and I'll probably talk about this more on Thursday on the program. There was a really good column recently in the New York Times by Ezra Klein, in which he wrote about the fact that during an international health emergency, such as a pandemic, the virus will often travel faster than the science can travel. In other words, we may not know exactly how it's transmitting. We have ideas. We may not know exactly, are masks 30% helpful, 50%? Is double masking an additional 10% benefit? Is it 30? Is it 50? Is it nothing? Yeah, so we need time to develop that. You cannot always wait for the science. Waiting for the science is great, but when you're in an emergency and the economy is shutting down and people are getting sick and some people are dying, sometimes you have to use your best information you have with the science from past studies and ongoing work and then adjust as you get it. Now, my understanding is on masking itself, there absolutely has been peer-reviewed study and helpful sort of collection of evidence and data. Dr. Sifra, I'm comfortable in saying I'll look for Ray on his behalf, and maybe by the end of the hour I can find a little collection here. But I don't think we're just supposing on masking anymore. I don't think it's 100%, but it certainly helps, doesn't it, Dr. Sifra?
Yes, I would agree. And I think that Ray's question gets to a good point, though, in that you have to be humble in all of this, mm-hmm. and you don't always know the answer when people are asking for an answer. And so you have to kind of be humble and realize that you may learn more information and that things may change and, you know, the virus may change or the science and the data that we are looking at may change. And so I really think that you have to keep it in perspective. And I can definitely appreciate the nuance to Ray's question in that regard.
Okay, Dr. Murray.
Yeah, we've never had a pandemic in the time of Twitter and social media. And so having this all roll out in front of everybody in such real time can be challenging. And the messaging can be very challenging, too, because it does move almost at the speed of light. You know, there are some old studies that keep on getting put out there by people trying to argue that masks do not work. Those studies were done pre-pandemic and done in a healthcare setting and done in a very different way. And we're asking a different question and really can't be applied to what we're facing now. So, you know, I agree we do have plenty of data showing real life experiences, kind of community-based data, because we can't really run a controlled study right now because that would be unsafe potentially to purposely have people go around without masks when we know that they are at great risk. So we look at kind of what's happening in different communities, and there has been plenty of data showing that masking has certainly been very beneficial.
And Ray and anyone else who's looking for evidence, a really good collection of the data came from January 26th of this year, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. More than a dozen co-authors from various backgrounds and disciplines across the country, and it is an evidence review of face masks and coverings against COVID-19. And it's a favorable review. Again, it doesn't mean that a mask perfectly protects you, but it does mean that we've got good and building evidence. And I urge you to Google that, check it out, what they have found. And good luck. And I appreciate that, Ray. And I always appreciate the phone call. Now, on the subject of sort of what happens next here, this comes from Denise, who says, I'm wondering if your guests have any knowledge of state masking requirements in schools going into the 2021-2022 school year. Who makes these decisions? I've already reached out to the governor's office as well as the Department of Health, but I've not heard back. I ask because I have a kid at home who's been remote since March of 2020, and I'd love to be able to semi-comfortably send him and his brother back to in-person school for their freshman year. That's from Denise. Dr. Murray, do we have any idea or guidance on what the rules will be starting in the fall when kids are back after the summer, and who's making that decision?
Quick, let me just say that for a high school freshman, good chance that that child will qualify for vaccination by the time school goes back in session mm-hmm. in the fall. So that will be an added layer of protection for that specific teenager. I have no specific knowledge. If Steve was still on the line, I think Dr. Cook probably would be the best person to answer that. But I'm assuming it will be like everything else and come from state health department guidelines.
And Dr. Cook is so important. He just had to jump off and talk to folks at the state because he's probably answering those questions as we speak.
And he's vaccinating right now. I think that you know, until we really have good herd immunity, my guess is that there's going to be some amount of masking that will continue in schools. the timing, I think, is pretty variable, but I feel pretty confident that at least those 12 and above will be allowed to be vaccinated before school gets back in session. I feel pretty confident in that prediction.
Okay. And Tom writes, and I'll just ask Dr. Siffer about this, about the mentality of wearing a mask. Tom says, regarding the issue of wearing a mask after the COVID pandemic, with COVID, mask wearing was primarily helpful to protect others from us. Would wearing a mask be that effective in protecting oneself against other people's more common illnesses? That's from Tom. Dr. Siffer, my understanding on this, and again, I'm always open to being wrong here, is that yes, for many months, the common refrain was wear a mask to protect others from yourself. You know, act as if you are infected and don't know it yet and protect others. But I think we got more data in recent months that indicate that masking, even with COVID, also gives us a protection from others who may be infected. So feel free to correct me if I'm wrong on that, Dr. Siffra, but also, what is your mentality about the purpose of mask wearing?
Yeah, so it absolutely protects others, but there is some protection for the mask wearer themselves. And so I think that it really, you know, it depends on the illness that you're trying to prevent. COVID may, you know, have be affected differently by mask wearing than, say, rhinovirus or RSV. And so I think that it's a little bit different, or it can be a little bit different, but there is some protection for the individual mask wearer that may make it worth wearing masks in certain situations.
Yeah, and I'll just add Patrick's email. He says, from 2010 to 2013, I traveled the country for business, and I landed in just about every major city in the United States. And the only people during that time that I ever saw wearing masks were Asian people who were traveling, probably international business travelers. Of those traveling from Asia to visit perhaps family or business contacts. And I used to think it was kind of strange, asking myself, what are they afraid of? Thinking through it a little further, many of these people probably came from densely populated cities where masking had become commonplace, and now I view it through a different lens entirely. It's actually the socially polite thing to do, especially if you're coming from another country and another densely populated city. The masks protect others from the mask wearer. Dr. Murray, you know, Patrick's saying his views have evolved. I have a feeling, generally speaking, that a lot of people are going to be in that camp, that even if they don't want to wear masks themselves on any given day post-pandemic, I don't think it's going to be viewed as strange at all. If you're on a subway train, a bus, an airplane, the grocery store, I think seeing masks for, I don't know, in perpetuity maybe, will be viewed as just, oh, that person might just be a little concerned or immunosuppressed or whatever. I mean, that's kind of my mentality. What do you think?
I agree. I think that, you know, it's not a big deal to wear a mask, and it certainly doesn't impact anybody else around you, and should not be something that should really draw any great attention. You know, we had plenty of children in our community who were immunocompromised before the pandemic who would have to wear masks, and they probably sometimes would feel that they kind of stood out because they were different because they had masks on, and now it's certainly much more of an acceptable, understandable thing. And so it's everybody's comfort level. And if wearing that mask makes you feel a bit more comfortable as you travel, whether it be to another state or internationally, I think there is probably some benefit to it. And it certainly is appropriate and a fine thing to do, and something we should certainly respect others' wishes to do so if they feel more comfortable.
I want to try to close the book on masking, and we got all this feedback. So two more quick ones here. In Canada, we talked to a Toronto-based doctor recently who said that he and his colleagues are already discussing just the possibility that maybe in the future, from, say, November to March, they'll think of it as mask season, because there is a seasonality to some illnesses, including the flu, including COVID, which we presume will maybe mutate or maybe sort of among us for a long time. And that in those cold months, maybe, you know, maybe something close to the level of masking we do now. Now, that's not something that is imminent or is definitely going to happen, but he said it's just something the colleagues have sort of mused about as a possible wise precautionary measure. Do you think, Dr. Murray, we will have a mask season in the future?
I think it's highly likely for healthcare providers that that'll happen. I'm not sure yet if it'll happen for the greater population, and I think we need to see what happens with variants, and we need to see what happens to RSV and the flu, which is Australia has been seeing some respiratory syncytial virus, and to see if, you know, if that disease has just kind of been pushed off to a different season. So we need a little bit more time to see how the rest of the respiratory viruses play out amongst the world of a COVID vaccine, too, I think.
Yeah, Dr. Sifra, could you see a mask season in the future?
I could, but I think it's going to be really highly particular to individuals' comfort and the situation. So like Dr. Murray was saying, in healthcare settings, I think that it's very likely that we're going to be wearing masks for a very long time, especially in flu and RSV season in the hospital. But I think that in those winter months, there probably will be people that choose to wear masks in certain situations, and there will probably be people that don't. And I think that there's going to be a wide range of behavior. But I think that a lot of it is going to depend on kind of what happens with the rest of the pandemic as well, and variants and that sort of thing.
And Dr. Cook is back with us. Dr. Cook, could you see a mask season in the future?
I definitely think there'll be a component of that. I think it'll be people's individual choices again. But it'll also hopefully be informed by science. If, you know, we're able to report, you know, increasing rates of flu or RSV or certain viruses in the community, hopefully people will make an informed decision, especially when they're in bigger social settings. So I definitely see it.
All right, let me squeeze in a call from Rebecca in Irondequoit. Go ahead, Rebecca.
Hey, Evan, thanks for taking my call. Maybe you can hear in my voice. I'm just recovering from a cold, tested for COVID. I was negative. But it made me think, and actually, ironically, I had a tickle in my throat when I went to get my second vaccine last Monday, and by the end of the day, I was full-blown sore throat and lost a whole week of work due to this cold. I am pro-mask, I'm pro-science, pro-vaccine, but I have two questions. One, is there any way that having this cold at the exact same time I got the vaccine, does that impact the efficacy? Like, was my immune system able to handle it, number one, and handle everything? And number two, as someone who works in a public setting, are there any potential side effects that we're over-sanitizing? Like, I've always been a believer in getting exposed to some viruses, some bacteria to build up our immune system. But now that we're protecting ourselves so much, is there a risk to that?
Kind of like, Rebecca, kind of like kids who grow up in cities and versus kids who grew up on farms. Kids who grew up on farms have far fewer allergies.
Perfect. Exactly.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. It's an interesting question. Dr. Murray, what do you think?
I think that from her immune system standpoint, she's probably just fine. It's unfortunate that she was sick right after she got the vaccine, but her immune system should be able to mount a response to both probably just fine, would be my guess, assuming otherwise a healthy person. With regards to the decontamination of everything, you know, early on, we were much more concerned about contaminated surfaces with coronavirus and, you know, what was the risk there, and we've learned a lot of that, and, you know, it's very clear that we don't necessarily need to worry as much about the deep cleaning of surfaces and all of that. And so a lot of those things, I think, can back off a little bit. Now, keeping our hands clean is really, really important. But again, wiping down every single surface in your house with a bleach solution is not going to be needed at this point. And I think that's true for businesses and probably even for schools as well. So, you know, a year of this is not going to be the end of the world. If we were to continue to never be able to stock, you know, Clorox wipes in our stores because everybody was continuing to use them so much for years, and I think we would have a problem. But I think now that we have more data showing that we can back off of some of that stuff as long as we're doing the good hand washing and we have good air circulation. For coronavirus specifically, I think we can back off a little bit of some of the deep cleaning that we're doing.
Yeah, and I think a very fair question, Rebecca, and it sounds to me like despite the fact that you might have had a nagging cold or something going on when you went to get vaccinated against COVID, sounds like you're going to be in really good shape, and I wish you well. Good luck. So nice to hear these stories of vaccination, and after our only break of the hour, let's get to the other side of this break and talk a little bit about the questions that some parents have sent in regarding kids and COVID. I know that there is sort of this push-pull that parents feel, this gratitude that COVID has not really been rough on kids, generally speaking. Not that it couldn't be or that there aren't isolated cases, but it has been remarkable in that it has mostly spared kids. There are some concerns about new variants, and I want to talk to our guests about some of the questions our audience has shared. So back in a moment with Drs. Cook, Murray, Sifra, and your questions on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we're joined by the Democrat and Chronicle's Justin Murphy, talking about his investigation into where teachers and school administrators live. The vast majority of administrators and teachers in Rochester live in the suburbs. And with hundreds of millions of dollars in salary flowing to the suburbs, what's the impact on the city and its schools and relationships? And what might change that? We'll talk about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and my goodness, listeners really like the idea that Dr. Murray floated, which is that schools can get rid of their perfect attendance awards. Bob writes in to say, I recently left a large professional office. The company policy was to receive a bonus if we do not use our sick time, which was substantial. As a result, several people would come in sick on a regular basis. They would pass around their germs, and this promoted a selfish attitude and a lack of empathy toward infecting others. I feel that leaders need to set the tone and promote a healthy work environment. Thank you. That's from Bob. Thank you, Bob. And Bob, among others, saying, let's get rid of all perfect attendance awards in companies and in schools. I mean, I go back, there's a 2014 show in which I cannot believe I was on the air. This was like around Thanksgiving in 2014. Now, I'd gotten over an illness. I felt better, but I sounded terrible. But what was I doing? I had listeners like, Evan, are you okay? And I'm going, yeah, I don't miss work. Well, my mentality may be about to change with that. Now, let's talk a little bit about variants. And I want to read an email from a listener named Jen, who says, hi, Evan. Dr. Michael Osterholm made some very concerning remarks about COVID and kids this weekend. Let me jump in. I'll get back to your email in a second. Dr. Osterholm is a member of the Biden administration's COVID task force, and he was on Meet the Press on Sunday. And the quote that Jen has in her email is accurate. This is some of what Dr. Osterholm said, so I'll read her email now. She says, did your guests see it? I'll copy and paste from NBC News. He said, quote, please understand this B.1.1.7 COVID variant is a brand new ball game. It infects kids very readily. Unlike previous strains of the virus, we didn't see children under eighth grade get infected often, or they were not frequently very ill. They didn't transmit to the rest of the community. Emerging evidence from Israel and Italy shows more young children are being infected with new variants of COVID-19. All the things that we had planned for about kids in school with this virus are really no longer applicable. We've got to take a whole new look at this issue. End quote. And then Jen says, Evan, that's different than what we're typically told about COVID and kids. My kids are back in school. Should I pull them out? I still don't know how much more likely they are to become seriously sick from this new COVID. That is from Jen. That last part is really important that Jen is raising here, because as much as I respect Dr. Osterholm, I think public health and task force members have got to be very, very clear about this. So let me just kind of give you an example. Let's just say there's a disease, not COVID. Let's say there's a disease in which 1 in a billion kids get sick from this new disease. Again, hypothetically. And then a new strain of the disease comes out and it's 1 in 500 million. Well, now you have doubled the transmissibility and the infection rate among kids. And if that's your headline, a lot of people are going to be scared. But it's still almost no kids. So what I don't know is if B.1.1.7 takes us from extremely unlikely to still extremely unlikely that kids get sick, but a little bit more, or a very, very different thing here. And I think Dr. Osterholm could have been a little bit more specific when he was on NBC News. Dr. Cook, let me start with you. What are we hearing about variants in COVID and kids?
Well, I think the important thing is that we have to do the variants surveillance tracking. And that's a very different test. It's not just the test. It's genome sequencing.
Yep.
And it's not easy to do. It's expensive. And that's one of the important things in the recent stimulus plan was, you know, billions of dollars to pay for additional sequencing so we can see exactly what is happening. What's also important with variants is variants arise when there's replication. So if kids are spreading the disease and they're asymptomatic and not getting very sick, but they're still spreading the disease, there's more chance for mutation and there's more chance for variants. So while they're not getting as sick, this is kind of what you would predict if a virus continues to replicate and be shared and transmitted. So it is a concerning aspect because we're vaccinating highly susceptible people, but, you know, we have to explain to the community in general that there's risk that these variants can change and could this become more dangerous in kids, perhaps, but at the very least, it's spreading more in anyone and understanding how the vaccines may or may not protect us against this. And right now, we don't have vaccines for people under 16. So how we have to treat kids, I think we need to keep doing the same distancing and masking as best we can, but also understand getting tested if there's symptoms, not blowing that off. And if you're sick, using contact tracing and following those directions is extremely important.
Okay, Dr. Murray, any concern that these variants, whether it's B.1.1.7 or otherwise, these COVID variants are infecting kids more seriously more often?
We're just starting to get some data on that because we're just being able to figure out which strain is which. So I'm concerned that it might be causing them to get more sick, but I don't think we have any conclusive information on that. We do feel pretty confident that it is something that's more transmissible. However, I think the key point here is that we don't have any evidence that our good precautions are not working. So that was a bunch of negatives. So basically, we have plenty of evidence still that masking and distancing and hand washing are still protective and good at preventing these variants from being transmitted as well. So, you know, can we get kids back into school safely? We probably can, but we need to make sure we still have precautions in place. This is not a flip the switch. People are getting vaccinated, so we're all back to normal. We still have to do a lot of work. So I think we have good evidence that the non-pharmacologic protective things, the hand washing, the distancing, the masks, is still very protective against these variants. But, you know, diseases are opportunistic. They want to survive and thrive just like every other creature does. And so, you know, if we vaccinate a bunch of really susceptible hosts, it's going to push the disease towards looking towards other hosts. So right now it's looking towards younger people to be able to infect. And as Dr. Cook mentioned, anytime disease is transmitted from one person to another, we risk the opportunity for a new variant to develop. So keeping transmission down regardless of the variant is so very critical.
And just because I know for parents this can be really nerve-wracking, let me just follow up to make sure I understand something, Dr. Murray, that you're saying there. When the virus is opportunistic and it's mutating and it is looking for more ways to survive and thrive, that could mean that it is more transmissible than it was in its earlier forms among kids, but that doesn't necessarily mean those kids are also much sicker. I mean, I guess the answer is it could mean that, but it doesn't automatically mean that kids would get sicker. It could mean that kids can transmit it more than they used to. Is that correct?
Correct. There's a lot of different components to the disease, right? And we parsed this one out, I think, far more than any other disease process we've thought about in modern times. So, you know, when it comes to coronavirus, we're thinking about how easy is it to spread from one person to another. You know, can people spread it asymptomatically? When people get it, how likely are they to become ill? How likely are they to become critically ill with it? And so there's just so many different factors. But right now it's looking like transmissibility is potentially greater with the B.1.1.7, but the jury's still out a little bit as far as does that make people, children who get it, more ill than the other variants.
Yeah, and I know
the original.
I know you're not the school czar and the gatekeeper of all the decisions and information. But,
oh, please say that again so that
I know you are not. I know you, Dr. Sifra, Dr. Cook, don't make all those decisions, and some people want you to. But Dr. Murray, as you raise schools, it doesn't sound so far like there's anything that has convinced you that schools should be shutting down right now in person.
Based specifically on the variant, you know, I think that's a very broad question, and there's so many things that need to be looked at. You know, what is the size of the building? How many students are in a building? What's the ventilation like? What's the community prevalence? You know, there's all of those factors are still need to be looked at. But, you know, the question of can we get more children back in school safely with the 3 feet rules is probably the case as long as we have the other things in effect and as long as our community disease prevalence stays down or comes down. You know, if we're in a situation where we have very high disease prevalence and then we're able to get data that perhaps it's a more transmissible variant is more prevalent, then that's potentially more concerning.
Dr. Sifra, what are you keeping an eye on most interested in when it comes to variants in kids?
So I think with everything with the COVID-19 pandemic, decision-making is really about analysis of the risk-benefit. And I think that the risks and benefits, particularly the risks, we don't know everything up front. And so it's something that I'm keeping an eye on. And I think that, you know, our local public health commissioner is keeping an eye on. But I think that it will likely evolve as we learn more. And like Dr. Murray said, keeping up with all of the other ways that we have to prevent transmission is really important.
And to the point of evolving understanding, as Dr. Sifra says, we did hear Monroe County say this week that they are rescinding the guidance that says yes to indoor hockey because of some concern about spread and outbreak. So, you know, we are going to see, especially the next month here. I mean, we are in a race with vaccination that, thankfully, it seems to be working against all of the variants. And we will see, especially in the next month, where this goes. But it is the people like our guest today who are out vaccinating. In fact, Dr. Cook, are you vaccinating someone like right now?
No, only because I'm not allowed to do that, but I am in the dome. I probably would get severely reprimanded if I were sticking a needle in a person right now and talking to them.
I'm mostly kidding. I mean, you really shouldn't multitask with a needle in your hand. But Dr. Cook, we appreciate what you are doing. Thank you for doing that, and let's talk again soon.
Thanks so much.
Dr. Nicole Sifra, same. Thank you for the work you're doing every day, and thanks for the expertise this hour.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Elizabeth Murray, always appreciate the perspective. Thank you very much, doctor.
Thank you. I appreciate the conversation.
And more connections coming up in a moment.